Welcome to the 114th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm glad you're joining me. I'd like to thank you for all the emails that I've received this week. Those of you that read my article and liked it on the frustrations of a plant-based cardiologist, that's on nutritionstudies.org. If you haven't read it, tells you a little bit about me and my insights. But thanks for your emails and questions in general, and I'm going to try to address a couple of them today. As far as what's going on with me since last week, I'm still training for the Mendocino 50K, and that's in 3 weeks. So I have managed to add some treadmill onto my morning runs. I run with my German Shepherds, if you're new to the podcast, so I do laps with them in flat Florida. So I've been finishing off with a mile or two of hills. I do a combination of either a long hill at a lower pace, and so I've been putting the treadmill incline up to the maximum 15% and pretty much doing a brisk walk, because I think that's what's going to happen on some of the hills, looking at the elevation in Mendocino. And then I also do some short intervals where I try to go at more of my race pace for shorter periods of time. Walking is different than running, no joke, right? But it does require a little bit of training to walk fast. I can remember way back many moons ago when I was in my cardiology training and we did cardiac rehab, people actually trained for their treadmill. So they would, a certain style of walking, they would learn to get their stride just right, use their arms, and you can actually improve your walking speed before you have to run. So anyway, so this method allows you to kind of practice that a little bit. And then, of course, just running up short hills will improve strength, hopefully. So that's what I've been doing there. I've also been pretty dedicated to my weight training with some squats, lunges. I had some outside weight work. Last week we were building a raised bed, and we put the base with cement blocks. So I was carrying some cement blocks, so that made for a bit of there's an exercise called a farmer's carry where you carry weight in both hands and you walk. So that was kind of what I did with the cement blocks. I will tell you, I didn't get very far with two blocks. I had to go with one. And the other thing I was doing, I added my bike back in. I hadn't been on my bike since the Ironman last year, so that would have been really negligent in that respect. I got introduced to a new app by a friend, called Zwift, and you can connect your bike trainer, especially if you have a Bluetooth type trainer, to your computer, and the Zwift allows you to ride with other riders virtually throughout the world, and you can see your speed, your heart rate. It gives you hills and different things to look at. So that was quite fun. It took a while to get it connected because there's a Bluetooth connection to your computer, and then it streams to your TV, and I wanted to connect my heart rate because I'd like to train with heart rate and cadence, so you can see all those little numbers that keeps you entertained while you're riding. So I kind of felt like a kid again trying to connect my video game up, but finally got that hooked up, and I got to say that it is a lot of fun, and I'm going to look forward to training that way. Before I would get on a trainer once or twice a week, just because it's easier to ride in the morning in the dark inside as opposed to out on the streets and risk getting run over. I'm really good at entertaining myself for the most part. I listen to someone else's podcast, or I'll do some videos on the computer and do intervals with them. The other thing I'll do is just entertain myself and go through the gears and do little intervals, 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off, do a high cadence pedal, slow cadence pedal. So you can entertain yourself for an hour, pretty good on a trainer if you kind of go through some of those drills. But this Zwift is a really cool thing. So if you get a chance to check out that app, I would recommend it. When I run, I kind of zone out for the most part. I usually start my runs with the dogs, and I need to pay some attention to what's going on there if I run with one or both, just to make sure that we stay out of the way of cars and dogs and squirrels and things like that. But oftentimes I just zone out. And when I was running with my daughter over the past couple of weeks when she was down visiting, she would say, did you see that? And it's like, no. And she would kind of get worried. But I do just kind of zone out in the morning. I mean, I'm aware of my surroundings as far as something's coming. But other than that, I don't pay much attention. I also run with a metronome still, so I'm trying to work on keeping my cadence up even when I'm tired or I'm on a day that I run easy. If my legs are a little sore, I still try to keep the cadence up, and I'm hoping that's going to work out better for me. And then, of course, when I do my long runs, I always listen to podcasts or audiobooks. So I encourage some of my patients when they go for their walks, because I want people to get out and move around every day. If you find it bored just getting out and walking, then, you know, turn into audiobooks is a good thing, or, you know, podcasts. But in general, I love being outside. So on a long run on Saturdays, you know, or Sundays, I just kind of zone out and listen to my podcast and enjoy the weather when I'm out. And it works out good. Now there's actually the loquat trees are fruiting. And that is a South American fruit that's plentiful in my area. A lot of people have trees that they don't even know what they are. For the most part, nobody eats the fruit. The birds get it or whatever. Because I haven't seen too many people ever actually picking the fruit. But I've befriended some people on my running route that I can pick their fruit. So I'll actually fuel my runs with the loquats as I go. And it's quite tasty, and it's kind of always fun to, even though I'm running on the streets, that I'm kind of foraging as I go. So I guess it's the would-be trail runner in me that wants to forage as I go along the way. And if any of the Mendocino people are worrying, don't worry, I'm not going to forage along the way. I'll wait for the aid stations. The first part of today's episode, I'd like to focus a little bit on beginning a plant-based diet or maybe maintaining a plant-based diet. And again, I do the six-week class, and so we're on class number two. So there's a lot of curiosity out there of what actually a plant-based diet is. And not everyone has had the courage to completely commit to being plant-based. So I kind of want to focus a little bit on the curiosity of being plant-based and the courage to start the change to becoming plant-based and the commitment to staying plant-based as far as your nutrition goes. You know, the curiosity comes when, you know, most people have seen Forks Over Knives, or when they have actually watched some of these documentaries, they certainly become curious as to perhaps the way that they're currently eating is not the best way. And certainly when people come to the office for their initial consult, I present nutrition as a means to reverse their cardiovascular disease. And some become curious. And I can actually, you know, I can see that on their faces. And sometimes I try to talk quick enough so that I can actually start to see that curiosity. Because at first it's kind of a, please don't talk to me about this. And then, you know, I kind of keep poking at different things till I can spur some curiosity. You know, Cinderella, I have three quotes that I use in my classes. But one starts that, you know, just because what is done doesn't mean it's what should be done. And, you know, that applies very well to the standard American diet. Just because it's what we all eat, this doesn't mean that it's what we should eat. And when you start to adopt a plant-based diet, somehow you have to go to another quote by Cinderella that says, imagine the world as it should be and not the way that it is. Because once you become plant-based, you start to see the world that is majority not plant-based, and so you're a minority as far as nutrition goes and eating out and everything. But if you can imagine what it would be like if you were in the majority, it might help just a little bit. And then the last one is have courage, be kind, and all will be well. And that takes us to the second part as far as courage goes, because if you don't have courage to start plant-based nutrition or change your nutrition, you'll never gain the confidence that you need to face the challenges of becoming plant-based, because the reality of it is there are challenges with regards to your family and your friends and eating out and changing the way you cook and maybe even how you feel. So you have to have that courage to start. And I think if you can, you know, address that, why don't you have that courage to start? Or if that's and perhaps that's a fear that when you change to a plant-based diet, it makes you recognize that maybe you're not as healthy as you once thought you were. And maybe that you really do need some improvement in your daily practices as well as your nutrition. So it kind of upsets the apple cart a little bit as far as, you know, it opens up a path that you need to walk on that you hadn't thought about, or maybe it opens up challenges that you really didn't really want to face at that point. I also heard someone talk to, you know, a little bit about, you know, suffering and fun in suffering. A lot of times when we do things and we're in the midst of it, it can be quite troublesome, and one thing goes wrong after another. And then we look back and we tell the story, and it's quite funny and quite humorous. I used to come back from most of my marathons with a funny story. During the marathon, it was never quite that funny. You know, the Paris marathon, thought I was going to freeze to death, and I was disappointed that I was, you know, cramping up and couldn't run. But looking back on it, it was a really funny story of how stupid I was to dress the way that I did, knowing full well that I wasn't going to run that fast of a marathon for those conditions, to be dressed so sparsely. You know, another marathon story was, you know, before being plant-based, I ate cheese before a marathon, which didn't turn out well. And I actually made so many trips to the woods and to the Port-a-Johns that I actually thought I was going to be dehydrated and question whether I could even finish it. And in retrospect, when I look back on it, it was a really funny story because my staff was tracking me on, you know, the athletic tracker, and I kept going off course, you know, and they wondered what was going on. Things were going so well, and there were a lot of funny stories. So a lot of times, you know, what you think is difficult right now turns out to be, you know, pretty funny and humorous and enlightening when you kind of look back on it. When we were first transitioning, when I was transitioning my family into a plant-based nutrition, my mom had cancer at the time and was undergoing chemotherapy. And, you know, so here we have, you know, she's a real trooper. She's going through chemotherapy and she's trying to, you know, be solid and be strong. But then I was serving her this whole new way of eating, and she was one used to being in control and being the cook. And so that was taken away from her. And then I'm making these dishes that are foreign to her. And so the best I could get out of her was, I could eat that. And that was the biggest compliment that I could get from her. And I used to be very frustrated because I was new to being a plant-based chef myself, as far as cooking for the whole family. And so I was very frustrated when people weren't excited to eat my new recipes. And so I'm sure some of you have experienced that as well, that, you know, you make this great dinner and you've tried and you've worked so hard only to face, I don't like this, this smells funny, what is this, this is not real. You know, there's all these different things that come back, and it's, at the time, very, very frustrating. And he's like, you know, why bother? This is, you know, such a challenge and nobody really cares. But when you look back on it after, you know, everybody's transitioned, those stories become quite funny. Athlon one time, and I was sat down with my plate of food at the finishing tent, and I was sitting in between two people with these big pile of ribs and burgers on their plate, and I was eating a bun with just the toppings on it because there really wasn't much in the way of plant-based options. There were some vegetables and fruit that I also had, but they both kind of looked at me at the same time, and they said, "Didn't you forget something?" You know, because I didn't have a hot dog or a burger on my bun, you know, so that, you know, that was funny in retrospect. And, you know, they, in the future, you know, they reminded me of that. You know, the other thing is, you know, transitioning to plant-based nutrition is when, you know, we have our holiday parties, and my son-in-law was at the house for the first time, and we were making so many different things again, because we want to present such a great variety of plant-based hors d'oeuvres and things to eat that, and we were really, my daughter and I were really getting behind, and Nathan asked if he could help. And I said, you know, could you, cut up some vegetables for the vegetable tray? And so I kind of turned my back on him, and I looked back, and he was, you know, chopping these carrots in such a way that they were just little tiny like you would put in a stew as opposed to eating on a vegetable tray, but he was doing it so meticulously and so carefully, like each of the carrots might feel pain when he was, you know, chopping them up. And we all just started to laugh. You know, I was like, Nathan, you're not making a stew. We want to make this for a veggie tray. You know, so I showed him, you know, what I wanted. But he had never done that before. And, you know, it was hysterical. And to this day, we really laugh about it. And, you know, now he's become quite the vegan chef himself. You know, I'm very proud. He makes tofu. He makes, he loves tuno, which is the sunflower seed tuna. He makes that and a whole variety of different vegan recipes for himself when my daughter's not there. So, you know, he's come a long way, and we can laugh about, you know, Nathan trying to chop a carrot. And so, you know, I'm really proud of he and my daughter for, you know, the meals that they put on the now. And they're quite excited to show their friends and to make dinners for their friends that are plant-based and pretty to look at. And they're so happy when, you know, people like them and they come over and they think, oh, man, this is great. It tastes great. It looks great. I want to try this. And they've actually been very successful in influencing some of their friends to become plant-based. People fear the I'm too busy, and that's their reason for not, or their biggest excuse for not becoming plant-based or maybe maintaining plant-based nutrition. And the reality of it is busy is a decision, and it's a choice that you make. We're never too busy to do what we want or find time to do what we want. And I do admit that sometimes something has to give, but you don't have to give up on being plant-based. You can make it less complicated, but you don't have to have to give up on it. You're only too busy if you want to be too busy. It's a good way to get out of things by saying, you know, I'm too busy. If you're too busy to shop to get all the vegetables needed, then, you know, make a list and stock your pantry with beans and rice and pasta and everything that you need so that you only have to pick up greens and perishable items on the week and fruit and things like that that'll, you know, and that's a quick shopping trip as opposed to the giant shopping trip, you know, with everything that you need every week. You know, people living in apartments can't maybe necessarily do that, so they can plan one meal a week and, you know, maybe eat it multiple times or, you know, recombine. So if you make beans, you can combine it with a variety of things and make that stretch out and to turn into different dinners. It could start out as just beans. It could then be a burrito. It could then be perhaps a soup. It could then perhaps be a lentil loaf. So you can pick one central theme and make that go all week if you don't have a lot of storage place. And then too busy to cook. Well, you know, it does take time. But most of the things that I put on the table, I can actually get from my door to the table in less than 30 minutes. With the Instapot, which is a electric pressure cooker, you can get, you know, your rice and beans done very quickly again. I make those ahead of time. I make those ahead of time for class when I bring beans to class or various grains. But again, it takes, you know, for the most part, takes 20 minutes to get all that stuff done when you're cooking them on the spot. Also, to make soups in the Instapot takes 30 minutes. Simple meals, you know, one of my favorite salads here lately is a Moroccan kale salad. And I actually microwave the sweet potato for 4 minutes that goes into that. The couscous takes a couple minutes. You can bring water to a boil. You've got couscous. To make lentils, it takes 5 minutes. So by the time you're chopping all your vegetables up, everything is cooked and you're ready to go. And that could be your whole dinner. So just a little bit of planning will help you do those things quickly so that busy is not really an option. Some people think they're too busy to exercise. This morning, you know, every week I talk about the push-ups and the push-up challenge, but I still continue to do my push-ups. And now I'm pretty much doing 100 push-ups every day. And some days, and I don't commit to doing 100 push-ups every day. I just say I'm going to do at least 22 push-ups. And 22 usually leads to 50, and 50 usually leads to 60, 65, and then it ends up being 100. But today I decided to try to time it to see how much time it actually took up, because I was procrastinating this morning. And I always do them after my morning run. And but I was procrastinating doing some stuff around the house. It's like, geez, I really don't have time to do the push-ups today because I'm going to be late. It's like, okay, I'll start and I'll at least get to 22 because it doesn't take any long to do them. So I did, I started doing my 22 push-ups. Well, you know, I thought, well, you know, at least do 30, 35, because that's what you can do without stopping for the most part, without too much trouble. And I decided to time it. So really by doing the 35 and then waiting a little bit, then I did 10 or 15 more, then I waited a little bit, then did 10 more, and then wait a little bit, did 10 more. About 7 to 8 minutes, I can get those push-ups in. So really, that's not a long time to do 100, to do something that actually gives you benefit. So whether it's walk by a push-up bar or a pull-up bar and do some of those, or do, you know, some squats, you know, set a goal for that, or, you know, body weight exercises. And if you do body weight exercises every day and you commit to those, it really doesn't take that long. So it becomes part of your routine. And, you know, you have a little bit of a rule. So, you know, my rule is I'm going to do at least 22 and see how I feel. And, you know, again, it goes on. The same way I have with running. I'm training for the ultra marathon. I want to have my mileage up. I don't want to get hurt, but I want to creep my mileage up. And I actually feel better when I run almost every day as opposed to take a day off. I don't really get any benefit from complete rest. Active recovery is one thing. You know, there's occasional days where I'm just too tired and I'll take a day off, but it's pretty rare. So I just say I'm going to get out the door for a couple easy miles, and I might even walk. I never walk, but I get out, and then the 2 miles usually turns to 3 and 3.5. But I don't put the pressure on myself to have a great run. It's just to get out and to get loosened up. So, you know, and take the dogs out, because it's like, okay, they're not going to get that much exercise if I don't take them out for their morning run, and they need that. So I have all these little things in place so that I can, you know, go out and get stretched out. I feel much better, even though I think I'm so tired. It's like, you know, I usually get up early to work, and then, you know, I'll go out for the run, and it's like, maybe I'm too tired to do it today. But as soon as I get out and do that, I feel better. And most people realize that after they finish exercise, they feel so much better than before they started it. So don't really put too much attention into how you're feeling before. Just get out there. And certainly if you get out there and you get a block down the road and things are really hurting and you can't get loosened up, then it's one reason to turn around. But I encourage you to just get out and do something every day and set it and give yourself these little goals. And, you know, you give yourself a break if need be, as far as what, how much, but give yourself a minimum too that you have to accomplish. And you're really never too busy to accomplish. So I had a patient, you know, talk to me. He's plant-based and he's doing everything he can, but his cholesterol's not out or not down to, you know, that magic number of 150 that makes him bulletproof. And, you know, bulletproof is relative. That means that the risk, if you naturally get your cholesterol down to a level of 150, then the odds of you having cardiovascular disease are pretty slim. But, you know, does that give you a guarantee that you're going to live forever? Absolutely not. We do the best that we can by getting, you know, eating as best as you can. You decrease your oxidation of your and decrease your free radicals, and your chance of having a heart attack are really, really low. But, you know, there's no guarantees in this life. And, you know, we try to do the best we can and live as healthy as we can. And, you know, you kind of let the chips fall where they may, so to speak. Which brings up Bob Harper. Bob Harper is a famous TV personality with The Biggest Loser. Very likable guy. I've never met him or spoken with him. I'd love to. Very fit guy, works out religiously, but he also advertised, you know, with on cooking channels that he started his day with a stick of butter in his coffee. And, you know, he would fast, but he'd high, you know, he was ketotic, he would eat high fat diet. And he actually had an acute myocardial infarction after working out and needed to be defibrillated, cardioverted. And it was by the place that he worked out having a automatic cardioverted or a external defibrillator that his life was actually saved. And he had angioplasty and stent placed, although he looked, you know, relatively healthy on the outside. Was he really lean? No. You know, on the Biggest Loser TV show, they would show very little about what they fed the people there. But when they did show it, it was associated with sponsors, you know, so Jennie-O Turkey and yogurt companies. So they were back to show these things. So they lost weight, but they didn't actually gain their health, so to speak. And, you know, he was now recently on a TV show recovering from his illness, and they showed him on a treadmill, and he's documenting that. And, you know, he talked about, you know, his genetics are bad and that everybody needs to know their genetics. And it's kind of like the old, you know, get your colonoscopy, get your mammogram if you have a risk for colon cancer or breast cancer. You know your genetics if you have a risk for cardiovascular disease. But what does that mean? It means that, you know, okay, so you have a risk of heart disease or cancer, but it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to turn those genes on. And knowing your genetics doesn't mean that you're, you know, there's anything you can possibly do testing-wise to change that course. What's in your hands if you have poor genes or you have, you know, you're genetically predisposed to coronary artery disease or cancer is that you need to eat healthy so that you don't turn those genes on to start cancer cells from reproducing. You don't need to help your body by giving it more cholesterol than it already makes or giving it fat to constrict arteries that are probably already diseased. So just because it's your genetics, that's 10% of it. 90% is still in your hands as far as what you turn on. So again, you know, they showed him exercising. He didn't out-exercise his coronary artery disease in the first place. So showing him exercise now is not going to fix the problem. His genetics haven't changed before and after. He can't change his genes. What he can change is his nutrition, and that's not being addressed anywhere, and it's very frustrating to watch. There's no place for TV marketing of a whole food plant-based diet. You know, you can't out-exercise your diet, and all you have to do is look at professional football players. They are very strong, they're very big, and they die earlier and have more heart disease, dementia, arthritis than any place else in the population. And it, you know, then it comes back and it's attributed to all the injuries that they sustain. Well, perhaps if they didn't have all the inflammation with what they're trying to eat to become so big, they wouldn't have so much inflammation. They're fed protein and protein and protein. You know, I think it's wonderful that Tom Brady is a spokesman. And I think, you know, a lot of other athletes or professional soccer players and hockey players that are saying, hey, our careers are extended longer if we eat predominantly a plant-based diet. These guys have youth on their side, you know. By the time their diabetes and hypertension show up in their late 30s, most of them are retired. You know, if you've ever seen the Super Bowl, they bring out the Hall of Fame players that are, you know, for the most part in their 50s or 60s, and they can barely walk out onto the field because they're so overweight and have so many chronic diseases. It's not unlike the spouses of some of my patients who think that they're healthy because they don't have any lifestyle diseases at the time that their spouse had a lifestyle disease. But it's just a matter of time whether the inflammation manifests itself as multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or Parkinson's or coronary artery disease or cancer. That's where your genetics play a role in. What part of your body is going to fail first is largely due to your genetics. But, you know, that doesn't mean the rest of it can't fail as well either. The other thing, you know, he was quoted in the article saying that, you know, the reason why he survived was he was in such good shape. Well, the reason why he survived was that there was a defibrillator close by. And when someone has a lethal arrhythmia, ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, the most life-saving thing that can happen is to have a defibrillator. That's why they're in the airports. That's why they're in gymnasiums. That's why they're in doctor's office. That's what saves your life, because it restarts your heart. If your heart stops, no matter how big your biceps are, your triceps are, your quadriceps are, you're not going to survive it, and it's not going to help you. You know, it's like an earthquake or a big tornado or a bomb, you know, with a giant building. It's built very strong, but it doesn't take much to bring it down when the right thing happens. You know, showing him back on the treadmill promotes his television show. It's a great story for comeback, and I wish him well. But, you know, I would love for him to incorporate how nutrition could play a role in really making him healthy and really making him have a long, happy life. I got an email saying that someone said that they liked the podcast, but they'd like to have a little bit more science. So I thought I'd throw a little science in the form of beans. You know, as most of you know, beans are loaded with fiber, so that makes them great. It helps you feed your good bacteria, which feeds back and decreases glucose production, increases your feeling of fullness, decreases cholesterol production. Beans are also loaded with protein. So for all those people that may be worried about their protein, you get adequate protein from your beans. But the color also has something to do with their nutritional value. The darker the seeds have higher levels of flavonoids. Gretchen is very vocal tonight. Oh, black beans and dark red beans have higher levels of these flavonoids. And with the flavonoids, you generate higher levels of, these are higher levels of antioxidants activity. So that promotes health. The beans are also very low in the amino acid methionine. Methionine has been associated with increased cardiovascular risk and increased aging. So meat products have a lot of the amino acid methionine. But so beans have high protein but low amino acid methionine, so it makes them very, very healthy. The class of antioxidants that beans have are the anthocyanins. Things that they do is scavenge free radicals, and those free radicals are generated by people that eat meat, but they're also generated by breakdown of cells for new, you know, general wear and tear of your body. So they help to maintain youth. So help to protect DNA breakdown and hormonal activity as far as developing diseases from estrogen stimulation. They produce, they help to support your immune system. They help to be an anti-inflammatory product to decrease joint inflammation. The maintaining the membrane strengthening of cell walls. So again, the bottom line is if you have a choice whether to eat things with color or not, eat the things with the most rich pigments, so the blacks and the purples and the reds. Another question asked of me is, well, so how do you eat your beans? Do you eat beans out of a can? Do you eat the hard beans? I prefer, when given the time, to eat the dried beans. So I soak my beans overnight and then rinse them and put them in my pressure cooker. And that way I have control. I often put some kombu in my beans when I'm cooking, if I remember, or I put cumin if I think I'm going to have more of a Mexican type dish, or make use of beans to make burritos, and I really like the cumin spice. But sometimes I use cans. So, you know, what kind of cans do I use? Well, it turns out that there's a variety of choices. Certainly, if you could can beans, then number one, if they're not organic, then they're going to be in a BPA-free can, and we'll come back to that. If they're not organic, they tend to have the most salt in them. And they can have up to 430 milligrams per serving. And it's usually a half cup serving per salt. So that's a lot of salt. So you want to make sure that you rinse your beans really, really good to get that salt out. The other thing that you rinse your beans for is to get rid of the natural saponification. Beans have a natural soapy type substance on their surface to inhibit bugs from penetrating into their tissues. So that soapy-like substance is released, and that's really the gas-causing substance for beans for the most part, that and the fiber and your gut bacteria. But if you rinse the beans really good, soak them and rinse them, then you get that saponification off. You don't get the BPA off. So the next step would be to buy organic beans. And if you buy organic beans, a lot of those come in, and you have to look, but they may come in a BPA-free can, and they also have less sodium, usually 230 milligrams of salt per half cup serving. The price goes up as well. And then if you take it one step further and you get... There's a brand of beans from the company Eden, which was introduced in 1999. It's very low sodium, and you can have up to 15 to 30. It can be down to 15 to 30 milligrams of sodium per half cup. So that's a tremendous savings. Plus, it's a BPA-free can. States is one of the last remaining companies that still allows BPA to line cans. And BPA was first manufactured as a synthetic estrogen in the 1930s, and it was also used along with a phosgene to create a toxic gas. Now it's used in plastics to make it shatterproof. So it's in shatterproof headlights, it's in eyeglass lenses, it was in baby bottles, it's in IV bags. But when the container that it's in is heated, so if your water bottle sits out in the sun, the BPA is actually released. And so the majority of people that have urine tested, there is positive for BPA. And this BPA has been linked to breast cancer and prostate cancer and a lot of other hormonal illnesses. There was a study done that looked at mice that were given and exposed to BPA. And the scary thing was that pregnant mice exposed to BPA gave birth to fetuses that had eggs that were also genetically corrupted, and so that they had defects in their offspring. So basically, BPA can affect not only the mother, but the child and the grandchild in mice species. It's not been documented in humans, but it's certainly scary. The U.S. FDA says that you can have 50 micrograms per kilogram of body weight of a BPA. And again, it's in lots of, in most people's urine. But you know, who wants that if you can avoid it? BPA interacts with estrogen receptors to cause these hormonal defects. And a lot of people, you know, soy gets a really bad name because it's you know, a phytoestrogen. Soy products block estrogen receptors so that you don't have the stimulation caused by estrogen. But BPA actually potentiates these estrogen and binds with estrogen receptors to cause these hormonal changes. So it's much worse than you know, anything that was proposed to be from soy. You know, so, but you know, nobody talks about it. We say that, oh, it's safe in most dosages, but if it's so safe, then why do we have such exposure in our urine? You know, how could it be that, you know, we're ingesting so much of this stuff? So if you can avoid BPA in your cans, I think it's a great idea. It's a reason to try to avoid plastic water bottles. If you can go to stainless steel bottles to carry your water in, it's much better, not to mention the fact that the plastic, you know, decreasing your plastic footprint is much safer for the environment. It's a shame IV bags still have BPA. And you just, you know, you think about it when things come on a truck or, you know, you have water bottles sitting in your car or water bottles were sitting in the delivery truck, how much BPA was released into that water. So no matter how pure that water might have been before, after it's been sitting in that water bottle all day long, you know, it gets into trouble. Same thing with your canned goods and everything else. It's leached in once it gets heated. Beans are funny. Some people say they love beans, and then other people say they hate beans. And people that say they hate beans, they always link it to this texture problem. And, you know, you ask them, what is the texture that you don't like? And people can't describe it. You know, I've heard people like refried beans, but not regular beans. I've heard people describe beans as being too mushy. So if you have somebody in your family that doesn't like beans, ask them, what about the texture is it that they don't like? a lot of it is, you know, kind of between your ears that they just never really ate them and they don't know what they taste like. Or they had beans that were undercooked perhaps and they didn't have any flavor other than they were just these hard things. Or maybe they were overcooked and they were too mushy. So, you know, kind of ask people, what is it about the texture that you don't like? And you kind of can correct that and try again. The other thing you can do with kids, you know, obviously is, you know, you make it one way or the other. So if they don't like it hard and crunchy, make sure you have like the mushy beans that you're making like a refried bean. I had a wonderful dish at a restaurant where they put the beans in a, they puree them and put them out like with a cake decorator that they decorated the plate with the bean puree. That's a wonderful, it went along great with the roasted vegetables. So if you didn't really like beans, you were getting this puree that was almost like a gravy. So that's a great way to cook them. Obviously you can hide them in a bean brownie for your kids. It's a way to get good beans and fiber and you're giving your kids a snack without problems. So black beans, and or a little rice flour and dates, and you have a great brownie, you know, and then start adding them to soups, you know, sneak them in here and there, and people, you know, find out what texture they like and go with that texture. Beans have also been shown to, and they don't know the mechanism, but your heart, people that eat about a can of beans a day have a lower heart rate, and a lower heart rate is associated with an increased survival. So, you know, there's no downside to benefits. You've got protein, you've got flavonoids and phytonutrients, antioxidants, fiber. So eat your beans. I think we'll wrap it up there for this week. As always, if you have any comments or questions, email me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. Or my website, please check that out as well. It's drdulaney.com, all spelled out, drdulaney. I'm on Instagram at jamiedulaney, as well as Twitter. So eat your beans, eat your fiber. Have courage, and all will be well. And until then, I'll see you next time.